From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I'm opposed to having a brother and sister be together and call that marriage. I'm opposed to an older guy marrying a child and calling that a marriage. I'm opposed to one guy having multiple wives and calling that marriage.
Do you think those are equivalent to gays getting married?
Oh, I do.
The Reverend Rick Warren, he's been chosen to deliver the invocation at President-elect Obama's inauguration. Many of Obama's supporters are outraged. We'll speak to journalist Max Blumenthal. But first, Democratic Congressmember Gerald Nadler. He's calling for an independent investigation of senior Bush administration officials, including Vice President Dick Cheney and former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Cheney recently admitted his role in authorizing Guantanamo Bay torture.
Did you authorize the tactics that were used against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
I was aware of the program, certainly, and involved in helping get the process cleared. That is, the agency, in effect, came in and wanted to know what they could and couldn't do. And they talked to me as well as others to explain what they wanted to do, and I supported it.
The number of Middle Eastern, South Asian, and North African men detained in the U.S. in the 8 weeks after 9/11, 1,182. Number of them ever charged with a terrorism-related crime, zero. Days after the U.S. invaded Iraq, that Sony trademarked shock and awe for video games, one. Portion of Baghdad residents in 2007 who had a family member or friend wounded or killed since 2003, three quarters. 25 years of the Harper's Index. We'll speak to Harper's Magazine publisher Rick MacArthur. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Wall Street Journal reports the United States is planning to start funding local Afghan militias to fight the Taliban in remote parts of Afghanistan. The first U.S.-funded militias will be established in Wardak province in eastern Afghanistan. The plan is based on a similar model used in Iraq. If the effort in Wardak is successful, U.S. commanders hope to create more militias in other parts of Afghanistan in early 2009. The militia push is controversial. Afghan President Hamid Karzai vetoed an earlier American proposal to create local militias because he feared they might one day fall under the sway of regional warlords. Canadian Defense Minister Peter MacKay has publicly opposed the initiative, saying it would be counterproductive. A federal jury in New Jersey has convicted five Muslim immigrants of conspiracy to kill U.S. military personnel. Prosecutors claim the men were plotting to kill U.S. soldiers at Fort Dix or another military base. Defense attorneys argue the men were entrapped by a pair of paid government informants. Fatin Schnur, the mother of one of the men, Mohammed Schnur, talked to reporters after the verdict.
This is not justice. This is not a justice. This setup for these kids. They give the criminal people like Mahmoud Omar and Besnik. They are killer. They are the criminal. They give this government is not justice. They give this criminal people money to put this innocent kids in the jail. And this is not justice. This is not United States. We came here for freedom, for good country. My son, he not kill nobody. He not buy any weapon. He not do anything.
The five Muslim men were arrested in May 2007 after two of the men tried to buy automatic weapons from an FBI informant. The same informant had helped scout out military installations for an attack, offered to introduce the men to an arms dealer, and gave them a list of weapons he could procure, including machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades. The five men face life in prison. The Associated Press has revealed many of the nation's largest banks are claiming they can't track how they're using the billions of dollars they've received in aid from U.S. taxpayers. The Associated Press contacted 21 banks that received at least $1 billion in government money and asked four questions. How much has been spent? What was it spent on? How much is being held in savings? And what's the plan for the rest? None of the banks provided specific answers. When Congress approved the massive bailout, it attached nearly no strings to the money, and the Treasury Department never asked the banks how it would be spent. The Iraqi parliament has delayed a vote on a resolution to allow British and other non-U.S. forces to stay in the country beyond December 31st, when the U.N. mandate expires. If an interim resolution is not passed before then, non-U.S. troops would have no legal right to remain in Iraq. Britain still has about 4,000 troops in Iraq. It plans to withdraw all but 400 of its troops from Iraq by the end of July. The Iraqi journalist who threw his shoes at President Bush last week said through his lawyer that he will not apologize for his actions. Montazar al-Zaidi has been held in prison for over a week. His attorney said al-Zaidi has been subjected to repeated beatings in jail. He has internal bleeding in his left eye, as well as bruises over his face and stomach. On Monday, White House spokesperson Tony Fratto was asked about the treatment of Montazar al-Zaidi.
Another subject. Is the White House at all concerned about reports by the brother of this Iraqi journalist who is being held for throwing his shoes at the president? His brother says in visiting the journalist in jail, he sees signs he's been tortured, missing a tooth, cigarette burns on his ears.
He's in the hands of the Iraqi system. I don't have anything more on the shoe thrower. I think it's been explored extensively, and I have nothing new for you.
The Washington Post reports European nations have begun intensive discussions both within and among their governments on whether to resettle prisoners from the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo as an overture to the incoming Obama administration. At least half a dozen countries are considering resettlement, but only Germany and Portugal have publicly acknowledged it. Meanwhile, China said today it wants Chinese detainees at Guantanamo to be returned to China if Guantanamo's closed. The U.S. is holding 17 Uyghurs, Muslims from Western China. The 17 have been cleared for release, but Washington fears they could be mistreated or even tortured if they're turned over to China. China says the 17 men belong to an outlawed group, the East Turkestan Islamic Movement. In news from Africa, the military in Guinea's taken control of the mineral-rich West African country hours after the death of President Lansana Conte. He had ruled Guinea since 1984. Following his death, the army announced it's dissolved the country's government and suspended the constitution. Doctors Without Borders has released its annual list of the world's 10 worst humanitarian crises. The list focuses on the massive forced civilian displacements, violence, and unmet medical needs in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Somalia, Iraq, Sudan, and Pakistan, along with neglected medical emergencies in Burma and Zimbabwe. Also included in the list is the lack of global attention to the growing prevalence of HIV tuberculosis infection and the critical need for increased global efforts to prevent and treat childhood malnutrition, the underlying cause of death for up to 5 million children per year. A coalition of environmental groups has sued the Bush administration in an attempt to stop the Environmental Protection Agency from changing a rule that'll make it easier for mountaintop mining companies to dump their waste near rivers and streams. Judith Peterson of Kentucky Waterways Alliance said, quote, "The notion that coal mining companies can dump their wastes in streams without degrading them is a fantasy that the Bush administration is now trying to write into law." The new rules overhaul a 25-year-old prohibition that sparked legal and regulatory battles for years. In Utah, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Salt Lake City said Monday it has not decided yet whether to prosecute a University of Utah student who disrupted a controversial federal oil and gas lease auction Friday by posing as a bidder and buying nearly 22,000 acres of public land near Arches and Canyonlands National Parks. The student, Tim DeChristopher, appeared in court Monday, but no charges were filed. A spokeswoman for the U.S. Attorney's Office said, quote, "It will take time to evaluate evidence and make a determination whether we will prosecute." On Monday, Tim DeChristopher told Democracy Now! He's ready to go to jail.
I've seen the need for more serious action by the environmental movement and to protect a livable future for all of us. I've seen that need for a long time, and frankly, I've been hoping that someone would step up and someone would come out and be the leader, and someone would put themselves on the line and make the sacrifices necessary to get us on a path to a more livable future. I guess I just couldn't wait any longer for that someone to come out there and had to accept the fact that someone might be me.
Visit democracynow.org to watch or listen to or read the full interview with Tim DeChristopher. In Brazil, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva paid tribute to environmentalist Chico Mendes Monday on the 20th anniversary of his murder. Mendes was one of the world's most prominent defenders of the Amazon rainforest. He was murdered on December 22, 1988, by ranchers opposed to his activism. Since his death, more than 1,100 activists and other rainforest defenders have been killed in Brazil. A new study by Brazil's Catholic Land Commission has found hundreds of Brazilian human rights and environmental activists still face the threat of assassination because of their fight against a coalition of loggers, farmers, and cattle ranchers. At the Vatican, the Pope has said saving humanity from homosexual or transsexual behavior is just as important as saving the rainforest from destruction. The Pope warned that gender theory blurs the distinction between male and female and could thus lead to the self-destruction of the human race.
È necessario che ci sia qualcosa come una ecologia dell'uomo.
We need something like human ecology, meant in the right way. The Church speaks of human nature as man or woman and asks that this order is respected. This is not out-of-date metaphysics. It comes from the faith in the Creator and from listening to the language of creation, despising which would mean self-destruction for humans and therefore destruction of the work itself of God.
Lesbian and gay Christians have denounced Pope Benedict's comments. The Reverend Sharon Ferguson of the Lesbian and Gay Christian Movement described the Pope's remarks as totally irresponsible and unacceptable in any shape or form. Ferguson said, quote, "It's comments like that that justify homophobic bullying that goes on in schools, and it's comments like that that justify gay bashing." And finally, the New York Times has apologized after publishing a fake letter to the editor Monday signed by the mayor of Paris denouncing Caroline Kennedy's bid to fill Hillary Clinton's Senate seat. The Times said the letter was a fake and that it was reviewing its procedures to verify letters to the editor. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Vice President Dick Cheney made headlines around the world last week when he admitted to direct involvement in approving the use of CIA torture. In an interview with ABC News, Cheney was questioned about the treatment of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was waterboarded over 100 times in U.S. custody.
Did you authorize the tactics that were used against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
I was aware of the program, certainly, and involved in helping get the process cleared. That is, the agency, in effect, came in and wanted to know what they could and couldn't do. And they talked to me as well as others to explain what they wanted to do. And I supported it. There was a period of time there, 3 or 4 years ago, when about half of everything we knew about al-Qaeda came from that one source. So it's been a remarkably successful effort. I think the results speak for themselves.
In hindsight, do you think any of those tactics that were used against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others went too far?
I don't.
And on KSM, one of those tactics, of course, widely reported was waterboarding, and that seems to be a tactic we no longer use. Even that, you think, was appropriate?
I do.
On Sunday, Vice President Cheney appeared on Fox News and once again defended the Bush administration's actions.
When you get into use of forces more time, means collecting intelligence. And therefore, I think you're fully justified in setting up a terror surveillance program to be able to intercept the communications of people who are communicating with terrorists outside the United States. I think you can have a robust interrogation program with respect to high-value detainees. Now, those are all steps we took that I believe the president was fully authorized in taking and provided invaluable intelligence, which has been the key to our ability to defeat al-Qaeda over these last 7 years.
This is at the core of the controversies that I want to get to with you in a moment. If the president, during war, decides to do something to protect the country, is it legal?
In general proposition, I'd say yes. You need to be more specific than that. I mean, but clearly, when you take the oath of office on January 20th of 2001, as we did, and you take the oath to support and defend and protect the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, there's no question about what your responsibilities are in that regard. And again, I think that they're bound to be debates and arguments from time to time and wrestling back and forth about what kind of authority is appropriate in any specific circumstance. But I think that what we've done has been totally consistent with what the Constitution provides for.
Cheney's comments come 1 week after a bipartisan Senate report accused former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and other top Bush administration officials of being directly responsible for the abuse and torture at Guantanamo and other U.S. prisons. The report says, quote, "The abuse of detainees in U.S. custody cannot simply be attributed to the actions of a few bad apples acting on their own. The fact is that senior officials in the United States government solicited information on how to use aggressive techniques, redefine the law to create the appearance of their legality, and authorize their use against detainees." The report was released by Democratic Senator Carl Levin and Republican John McCain of the Senate Armed Forces Committee. It was based on a nearly two-year Senate investigation. Well, on Friday, Democratic Congressmember Gerald Nadler of New York called on Attorney General Michael Mukasey to appoint an independent counsel to investigate Cheney, Rumsfeld, and other senior Bush administration officials on torture charges. Congressmember Nadler joins us here in our Firehouse studio. He is chair of the Judiciary Subcommittee on Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Talk about the significance of this report and what you're calling for.
Well, the report was an official finding of the Senate Armed Services Committee on a bipartisan basis, essentially, that the United States government, through the high officials of the Bush administration, authorized torture and cruel and degrading treatment of prisoners. It found, in effect, that the United States government, through high officials of the Bush administration, deliberately and knowingly broke the law. Broke the Convention Against Torture, which is an international treaty to which the United States is a signatory, and which, therefore, under the Constitution, is the supreme law of the land. Broke the Anti-Torture Act, which is an United States law. And the morality of this aside, you cannot have high officials deliberately breaking the law without accountability. The vice president, on that interview we saw a few minutes ago, talked about the oath of office the president, the vice president, others take, and that is to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. You are not preserving it, and you are not defending it. You are, in fact, perverting it if you deliberately break the law, which is the supreme law of the land pursuant to the Constitution. It is imperative, if the United States is to remain a country of laws and not men, that people who break the laws be held accountable. And that's why I called for, now the administration is not going to investigate itself. I sent a letter to the Attorney General 3 years ago when the illegal wiretapping without warrants against the FISA Act was first revealed, demanding that he appoint a special prosecutor. I repeated that to Mukasey when he became Attorney General, and they've ignored that. So I sent another letter, this time saying, here's a prima facie case. In terms of the findings of the Senate committee and the few days later, the admissions by the vice president, which is an admission of guilt in breaking the law, that there were deliberate violations of the law, it is your duty under the law to appoint the special prosecutor, which is what I've asked for.
And you know Mukasey comes from here. He comes from New York.
I know Mukasey, yes. And I fully expect that he will ignore that law, that letter. I fully expect that he will ignore, as the entire Bush administration has from its inception, the requirements of law. And there are things that it is imperative that the Obama administration, when it takes office, and the Congress in January, take steps to hold officials accountable for violations of law. And really, not because we want vengeance, and not because we want to be vindictive about what happened, but because holding people to the law and making them go through a legal process of proving guilt or innocence is the only way that you can minimize the likelihood of recurrence of lawbreaking and maintain the United States as a democratic country.
Do you have any indication the Obama administration would do this? It's interesting that it's John McCain, together with Senator Levin, who puts out this very damning report on Rumsfeld.
We don't know what the president is going to do. He has said in the past that people ought to be held accountable. He's also said that we are not going to be looking to punish people from the past. I am sure he will get advice that says, Mr. President, be a uniter, not a divider. Look to the past, not the future. That is poisonous advice. because it guarantees, if nothing is done, that the next time some irresponsible person becomes president or secretary of defense or undersecretary or whatever, that this kind of thing will happen again. We have now seen several presidents. We saw President Reagan, President Bush, pardon people in their own administration for crimes. It may be that President Bush will do the same thing. And what this means is that it opens the door and it invites future administrations to commit crimes.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, you rarely have Cheney being so open about, well, this is the first time he says yes, he endorsed this, he supported mm-hmm. it, he initiated it. Is he doing this because he wants a pardon for a pre-pardon, even
well,
if...
Well, maybe.
And what does that mean?
What does what mean?
A pre-pardon.
Well, it's not a
pre-pardon. He's not charged.
No. It's not a pre-pardon, a preemptive. The pardon power is pretty unlimited. Some people would say totally unlimited. And certainly, President Bush, the first President Bush, pardoned people who had not yet been charged with a crime. It is entirely possible that this President Bush will say, I hereby pardon anyone who, between September 11th, 2001, and December 31st, 2008, allegedly violated the statutes against torture or whatever. He could do that. That's a preemptive pardon. I think it's wrong as a matter of, not as a matter of law. It ought to be wrong as a matter of law.
Who did the first president preemptively pardon?
Well, he pardoned Caspar Weinberg and various other people for their alleged roles. I say alleged because it wasn't proven because the trials were aborted by the pardon in Iran.
They indicted at that point.
I don't recall whether they were indicted or not. Now, President Carter pardoned all people who were draft evaders. They could come home from Canada. And they hadn't been indicted, and he didn't mm-hmm. use any specific names. So the pardon power is pretty unlimited.
And President Bush Sr. issued these pardons on Christmas Eve.
On Christmas Eve.
Right before
it remains to be seen what President Bush will do. But this is an ongoing long-term battle. And whether President Bush issues pardons or not, I think we have to take a number of legislative steps to rein in the what is now the inordinate power of the executive branch to break the law with impunity. One, I am going to introduce legislation in January to restore the old special prosecutor statute, the one that Ken Starr abused. It'll have a protection in it. It'll say, and what this says is if the administration doesn't appoint a special prosecutor to investigate crimes it committed, then anyone can go to court and get a court to appoint a special prosecutor. But it will say only for official crimes committed by an administration that are as official acts. That'll be a sharp limitation on that power. Secondly, I'm going to introduce a constitutional amendment to restrict the president from issuing pardons for official acts by members of his own administration and from pardoning anyone except for a crime for which they've already been convicted and from issuing any pardon in the last several months before his term of office is over so that there's some political accountability. And finally, and perhaps more important than anything else, we have to pass the state secrets bill that I introduced in the House and Senator Kennedy Inspector introduced in the Senate, because the only way you can enforce any rights in the Bill of Rights is either by prosecuting someone who illegally kidnaps you or tortures you or whatever, and if the administration won't prosecute itself, you got a problem there, or by suing the administration for false arrest, for false imprisonment, for torture, whatever. But now the administration comes in and moves to dismiss any civil case on the grounds that hearing the case would necessitate the revelation of state secrets to endanger the national security, and the case just gets dismissed with no showing that that is, in fact, the case. So we have to stop that,
Congressman
too.
Adler, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, I want to ask you about that open Senate seat. We've heard a lot about Caroline Kennedy. We've also heard your name. I also want to ask you about the economic crisis and continue on this issue of torture. Congressman Gerald Nadler represents New York's 8th Congressional District. He will be entering his 9th term as a congressman in the next Congress. This is Democracy Now! Stay with us. Alice Coltrane here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on close to 800 stations on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines also available in Spanish for any radio station to take, as over 200 are. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is Congressman Gerald Nadler. He represents New York's 8th Congressional District. It goes from the Upper West Side down right to Ground Zero.
To, in fact, Coney Island.
In Brooklyn.
Yes.
Speaking of districts, are you interested in the Senate seat?
Certainly.
And what is the politics that goes on behind this?
Well, that's very hard to know. This is an appointment. It's entirely internal to Governor Patterson's head, so one doesn't really know what the politics is. Obviously, the people supporting the people supporting Caroline Kennedy think that a public campaign would be helpful. Other candidates have not been doing that. I have not been doing a public campaign, and no one really knows.
Have you talked to Governor Patterson privately?
Yes.
And do you think Caroline Kennedy is qualified to be senator?
Well, that's up to Governor Patterson to decide, and I'm not going to comment on that. All I'll say is that I think that's the wrong question, and the press has been asking the wrong question. The question should not be, is Caroline Kennedy, or any other individual, for that matter, qualified? Because the assumption there is if you meet the certain minimum qualification, you're entitled to the seat. The question ought to be the same question anyone hiring someone for any responsible job would ask, and that is this person the most qualified of all the available candidates? That's the relevant question.
And why do you think you're the most qualified?
Well, I think all the candidates think they're the most qualified. I think my record in Congress is a very progressive and forward-looking record. I think I've shown very good judgment. It's one of the few downstate people who voted against the war, against the Patriot Act. They've taken a leadership role on civil liberties, on economic development, and I led the battle for 8 years against the bankruptcy so-called Reform Act of 2005, which we now recognize is probably responsible for maybe a third of the foreclosures that are going on in this country.
Which Vice President-elect Joe Biden championed?
Well, he supported it. About a third of the Democrats in the House voted for it. And I think my record on economic development in New York, in terms of port development and transportation, has been a very far-seeing record. But, you know, all of this is for the governor to weigh, and other candidates have other merits and other accomplishments, and he's got to weigh all of them.
In terms of how you fit in with the new Obama administration, the path you're taking now, pushing, for example, 1531, which urges President Bush not to pardon people. This is not the path of the Obama administration.
Well, we don't know what the path of the Obama administration is. As I said earlier, we will see. I certainly hope that the new administration will recognize, and there are comments from the president-elect and from Eric Holder, who's going to be the new attorney general, and from other people. All over the lot on this, frankly, so it's impossible to predict. But I would hope that they would recognize a necessity to investigate whether crimes were committed and if they were to prosecute them, more to the point, not to hold high government officials automatically exempt from the normal processes of justice, because to do that is to loosen the bonds that protect us all.
Congressman Nadler, I want to ask you about impeaching the president. Now, I know people are going to say, what do you mean? He's leaving office. Vice President Cheney, he's leaving office. Why would you impeach? But you can impeach these men after they leave office. And why would you?
Well, I don't think it makes sense to do so, but it's technically probably possible. It's never been tested, because the Constitution says that someone who's impeached, the punishment shall extend only to a removal from office, which is obviously irrelevant if they're already out of office, or and to disabling them from holding any office of profit or trust under the United States. So if Congress could decide to impeach somebody in order to prevent him from being elected or appointed to anything in the future. Now, whether it makes sense to do that is another question. I frankly think that it's a lot more important to hold people accountable in terms of the criminal law than to do that at this point, and a lot more practical to do it, because an impeachment, number one, is politically not in the cards, and number two, would completely distract Congress as a whole when it has some rather urgent tasks, like saving the world economy, in front of it.
Let's talk about that. In the world economy, let's start right here in New York or in this country, the global economic meltdown. You heard the headline about the lack of accountability of the banks, what they're doing with this money. You've got the executive loophole, which is now the CEOs can get bonuses at the end of the year, though that was not the intent originally. They've changed the language to allow this to happen. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are, frankly, that this is the Bush administration acting in its usual disgusting way, in subverting the intent of the law and not enforcing the law as it was intended. I'm sure that as soon as the Obama administration comes in, they're going to use the ample powers that the law gives the administration to govern the use of the funds to make sure that those abuses don't occur. It's just unfortunate that we still had the Bush administration for the last 4 or 5 months. And I don't think Congress had much choice but to pass the legislation that we did. The economy is on the brink of an absolute catastrophe. I've been saying for 6 or 7 months now that we're in 1931. In 1931, a recession that started with the crash of 1929 tipped into a 15-year depression. We are on the precipice of that. If we are very lucky, and if we do everything very right from now, we will probably have a 2 or 3 year very bad recession. If we're not very lucky, or if we don't do everything right, we could easily have a 10 or 15 year depression, a repeat of the 1930s. And we have to pull out all the stops. We have to do a very large stimulus package, I think at least $1 trillion over 2 years, to put aggregate demand into the economy. That's not enough. We also have to take steps to restore aggregate demand after that occurs. This is the result of 30 years of deregulation and 30 years of redistribution of power to the very top, so that essentially 95% of the benefits of the doubling of the GDP that's occurred since 1980 has gone to the top 5% of the population, which means that there's a demand crisis. People don't have enough money to buy things. And that occurred with regularity every 20 years before the New Deal. Hasn't happened since the New Deal, because in the New Deal we put in various protections which we've systematically dismantled since the Reagan era. We've got to put those protections or more modern versions of them back. We've got to pass the Employee Free Choice Act and get a robust union movement again, which is the only thing that guarantees that not everything goes to the top 5% and you have a real middle class. And that guarantees that with a real middle class, their buying power in society is broadly enough distributed so that you, in fact, don't get into a deflationary spiral.
Did you know Bernard Madoff?
No. Well, a friend of mine says that I did in the 80s, that we served on on the Metropolitan Council of the American Jewish Congress together. That was a body of 60 people. I have no memory of him from the 80s.
And what about the regulation of the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission?
Well, obviously, it was totally incompetent and inadequate. It's got to be changed.
We just were listening to Vice President Cheney. One of the remarkable things he said was, well, as you pointed out, echoing back to Nixon. If people have seen Frost Nixon, we just had Ron Howard on, that issue of if a president does it, it's not illegal.
Well, that's the definition of a monarch. We rebelled against that notion in 1776, and in fact, it is just completely either ignorant or malevolent. It's the antithesis of a democratic country. It's the antithesis of the rule of law. The whole point of the way they drafted the Constitution was that they didn't want the president to be an elective monarch. A president, anyone in this country, must be subject to the rule of law and not above it. The people are sovereign, not the president. And someone who says that if the president does it, it's legal, betrays the Constitution and betrays the entire goal of American government, which is to have rule by the people, not by a king.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Congressmember Gerald Nadler of New York. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. President-elect Barack Obama is drawing criticism from many supporters for his choice to deliver the invocation at next month's inauguration. Obama selected the Reverend Rick Warren, a leading evangelical opponent of abortion and same-sex marriage. Warren supported California's recent gay marriage ban and has compared abortion to the Nazi Holocaust. In a recent interview with the website beliefnet.com, Warren said he thinks gay marriage is comparable to incest, polygamy, and child abuse.
I'm opposed to having a brother and sister be together and call that marriage. I'm opposed to an older guy marrying a child and calling that a marriage. I'm opposed to one guy having multiple wives and calling that marriage.
Do you think those are equivalent to gays getting married?
Oh, I do. I just say, for 5,000 years, marriage has been defined by every single culture and every single religion. This is not a Christian issue. Buddhists, Muslims, Jews, historically, marriage is a man and a woman.
The Reverend Rick Warren speaking to beliefnet.com after Warren's inauguration appearance was announced, Obama was forced to defend his choice.
It is no secret that I am a fierce advocate for equality for gay and lesbian Americans. It is something that I have been consistent on and something that I intend to continue to be consistent on during my presidency. What I've also said is that it is important for America to come together, even though we may have disagreements on certain social issues. And I would note that a couple of years ago, I was invited to Rick Warren's church to speak, despite his awareness that I held views that were entirely contrary to his when it came to gay and lesbian rights, when it came to issues like abortion. Nevertheless, I had an opportunity to speak, and that dialogue, I think, is part of what my campaign's been all about.
President-elect Barack Obama speaking in Chicago last week. I'm joined now by Max Blumenthal, Puffin Foundation Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute. His work has appeared in The Nation, Salon, and many other publications. Currently writing a book on the U.S. evangelical movement. His latest article, Rick Warren's Hypocritical Double Life, is online at dailybeast.com. Max Blumenthal joins us via DN video stream. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Max.
Yeah, great to be here.
Talk about the history of Rick Warren.
Well, the history of Rick Warren is pretty interesting, and you heard some of his views right there. These are views that people have only recently started paying attention to. Prior to this controversy, Rick Warren was, you know, proffered by the media as the voice of the new evangelical movement, which embraces environmentalism and fights poverty and is going to move beyond the old hobgoblins of the Christian right and the old, you know, draconian figures of the Christian right, like James Dobson and Pat Robertson. Rick Warren was supposed to be the pioneer of this new movement. He is the founding pastor of Saddleback Church, a mega church in Orange County, and he's the author of The Purpose-Driven Life, which is a, you know, sort of subtly Christian self-help manual that sold 25 million copies. So he has a really broad appeal, and he's planted churches across the world, especially in Africa. And because, you know, the media has expected evangelicals, especially conservative evangelicals, to be draconian and retrograde, you know, they've made a hero out of Rick Warren without looking at who he really is and what he really believes. Nicholas Kristof from the New York Times, for example, has called Rick Warren an evangelical liberals can love. Newsweek named Rick Warren one of the 15 people who make America great. And even The Nation, which I've written for, you know, the venerable left-wing magazine, in 2005 published a piece calling Rick Warren America's pastor. You know, he wears a Hawaiian shirt. He looks like a big teddy bear. He doesn't holler or hector. He speaks in a ponderous tone. And he does seem to genuinely care about the environment and care about poverty. It's not clear what he's actually done. And he's been pumped up by a small group of Democratic consultants who urged Barack Obama first to go to his church and speak with him, and then to participate in a debate this August that was broadcast by CNN, the Saddleback Forum, where Rick Warren essentially got to interview both candidates sequentially, John McCain and Barack Obama, on the issues and serve as the national minister. The debate went really badly for Obama because Rick Warren asked him a trick question about abortion. When does a baby get human rights? Barack Obama couldn't answer it. Soon after, he was attacked by right-wing radio hosts for his answer because he said, you know, this question is above my pay grade. And Rick Warren even went on a conservative radio show and, you know, chuckled about Obama's response and kind of lightly mocked him. So the real Rick Warren is someone who fights the culture war with a velvet glove. He's a religious right figure who's figured out a new strategy to move into a Democratic post-Bush era and still hold influence. He freely admitted to a reporter from the Wall Street Journal that the principal difference, the only difference between him and James Dobson, is a matter of tone. And when I called Rick Warren's PR handlers, you know, the people that are responsible for making him into this major national figure, from Larry A. Ross Communications, they kind of laughed at the idea that he was America's pastor. They said he's consistent with what the Bible teaches. He's not trying to be America's pastor or whatever. So Rick Warren openly backed Proposition 8 in California last November. This November, he did so in the terms that you heard him speaking to Stephen Waldman, essentially saying that 2% of our population, the homosexual population, was trying to dictate to the rest of us, which is a really demagogic thing to say. He told that to his congregation, and he's backed every anti-gay proposition that's come down the pike in California in the last 10 years, including Proposition 22, which laid the groundwork for Proposition 8. He joined up with James Dobson and Charles Colson and Tony Perkins and these people to do this. Beyond that, he compares pro-choice advocates to Holocaust deniers. He recently was interviewed by Sean Hannity, and Sean Hannity asked him, should we attack Iran? And Rick Warren said, well, it's our God-given obligation to take out evildoers. He has recently scrubbed material from his website claiming that man walked the earth with dinosaurs, basically that, you know, history is one big Flintstones episode. He will not allow homosexuals to be members of his church, and he recently scrubbed that from his website. So it's just interesting to me that people are finally paying attention to this after Rick Warren has never tried to hide his views. He's never really gamed the media. It's just that progressives has finally drawn the line where Barack Obama has not.
You write about one, Rick Warren saying he doesn't feel that, you know, politics and religion should be mixed. But you also talk about how in the last days of the presidential race of Bush's 2004 reelection bid, Warren sent an urgent blast email to hundreds of thousands of evangelicals insisting they base their votes on five non-negotiable issues: abortion, stem cell research, gay marriage, human cloning, and euthanasia.
Right, and this is before Rick Warren became a member of the One campaign, before, you know, the media had began puffing him, and before, you know, people, Democratic consultants like Mara Vanderslice, who ran a sort of Christian front group for Obama called Matthew 25, you know, self-proclaimed progressive evangelicals in the media like Amy Sullivan began presenting him as one of the new evangelicals who is going to take us beyond the Christian right. But the evidence was there that Rick Warren had sort of insidiously backed George W. Bush by saying that pastors had to vote and urge their congregations to vote on issues like abortion and homosexuality. If you vote on those issues and you say that those issues are non-negotiable, then of course you're going to vote for George W. Bush, and of course you're going to back the Republicans for Congress. Beyond that, you know, Rick Warren says he's for the environment. Rick Warren says that he's for fighting poverty, which is great. But what has he actually done? You know, I've spent hours scouring the internet and calling around trying to find some results that Rick Warren has produced in Africa against AIDS, results he's produced against poverty. And all I can find is that his peace programs, which he calls them, are sort of recruitment vehicles for the churches that he's planning in Africa, and that he is using these programs actually to evangelize, and there's no real way of measuring his results. Now, and there are Christian groups that are doing good work, you know, in the third world, that are fighting poverty, and they measure results. Groups like Medical Teams International, even World Vision measures results. But we have no way of knowing what Rick Warren is doing. It looks to me like he's going around to the Aspen Institute and to these big elite festivals and telling people who expect evangelicals to be retrograde and who expect evangelicals to be draconian that he's doing something different. And he speaks the language that people want to hear in the media manufactured age of postpartisanship. But it's unclear what he's actually doing beyond fighting the culture war with a velvet glove.
Max Blumenthal, let's turn to another clip highlighting some of Rick Warren's views. Earlier this month, he was interviewed by Ann Curry of MSNBC.
If science finds that this is biological,
yeah,
that people are born,
yeah,
to be gay, would you change your position?
No, and the reason why is because we all have biological predispositions. I'm naturally inclined to have sex with every beautiful woman I see. But that doesn't mean it's the right thing to do.
That's Rick Warren. Max Blumenthal, final thoughts.
Well, that's a bizarre remark I haven't heard. And, you know, I like to get to know women first. And I think, you know, most people do. Rick Warren has a doctrine of women's submission, which he preaches to his church. And he tells the female members of his church that they have to support their husband's decisions, even if they make bad financial decisions, because women have to submit in a biblical manner to their husbands. So this goes way beyond being anti-gay. He's, you know, patriarchal. He's supported assassinating Iran's president. And he's just, you know, I have no problem, and I don't think anyone should have any problem with Barack Obama going to Rick Warren's church and meeting with him or working with him on good initiatives. But the question is, where does Barack Obama draw the line when someone demonizes a segment of Americans? Is this person really fit to address the nation and confer God's blessing on the entire United States of America? When Rick Warren freely admits that he only believes that a small segment of Americans are going to heaven and that the rest of us are going to burn in an everlasting lake of fire, that's the question. And I think that Barack Obama has answered it, but at the very least, progressives have drawn the line here, and I think they should hold the line.
Max Blumenthal, I want to thank you for being with us, Puffin Foundation Writing Fellow at the Nation Institute, writing a book on the evangelical movement. His latest article is called Rick Warren's Hypocritical Double Life. It's online at dailybeast.com. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, it's been 25 years of the Harper's Index. We'll be joined by Rick MacArthur. He's the publisher of Harper's Magazine. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Harper's Magazine is marking the 25th anniversary of its popular monthly feature, the Harper's Index. The index reports sometimes funny, often sobering political realities through statistics and unusual figures. Turn to this month's edition. You'll find out things like how much the Bush campaign paid Enron and Halliburton for use of corporate jets during the 2000 recount, or the estimated total calories members of Congress burned giving President Bush's 2002 State of the Union address standing ovations. You can find the answers to these and many more in the special three-page 25th anniversary Harper's Index in the latest issue of Harper's Magazine. I'm joined right now by Harper's Magazine publisher Rick MacArthur. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Delighted to be here, Amy.
Well, what are some of your favorites in the Harper's Index retrospective of the Bush era?
Well, some of my favorites are funny, and some are amazing, and some are depressing. I mean, the ones that really caught my attention this month, and this is extra long. Normally, we just have one page, 40 statistics. This time, it's expanded because of 8 years of Bush requires a little bit more research. But minimum number of times that Frederick Douglass was beaten in what is now Donald Rumsfeld's vacation home, 25. Now, that's in the realm of tell me something I didn't know. This I did not know.
Well, wait one sec. I just want to explain, since I have visited this place in St. Michael's, for people to understand that Frederick Douglass, who was enslaved as a teenager, given over to a slave breaker named Edward Covey. His home was called Mount Misery. And he was beaten there. They tried to break Frederick Douglass there. That property today, Mount Misery, is owned by none other than the former Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. And I visited. I went down Mount Misery Road, and there on the end, there's the Secret Service. This was when he was Secretary of Defense. Got out. I got out with my video camera. I thought, could Donald Rumsfeld not know this history? And there was a stake in the ground, and it said Mount Misery. That's where Frederick Douglass was tortured.
And has anyone asked Donald Rumsfeld if he knows the significance? Presumably, he knows it now. If he didn't,
Well, I went to the local black church, and I asked some of the folks who were in the sanctuary before Mass what they thought of Donald Rumsfeld owning that property where Frederick Douglass was tortured. And they said, one woman said to me, I can't comment right now. I'm in church.
Well,
keep going.
But this is the thing about the Harper's Index is that the numbers pose questions. That's the whole point. This is a continuing conversation. So you can think about this, and then you read the statistics that come after the Frederick Douglass number. Estimated number of juveniles whom the United States has detained as enemy combatants since 2002, 2,500. Minimum number of detainees who were tortured to death in U.S. custody, 8. Minimum number of extraordinary renditions that the United States has made since 2006, 200. And then date on which USA Today added Guantanamo to its weather map, January 3rd, 2005. Now, we try to liven it up with numbers like the weather map number, but the point of this, obviously, is to show the continuity in American history. Frederick Douglass being beaten, tortured before the Civil War, and detainees, foreign fighters, quote unquote, being tortured in recent times, in modern times. Things haven't changed as much as we'd like to imagine.
Days after the U.S. invaded Iraq, that Sony trademarked shock and awe for video games.
Right.
One.
Right.
Percentage of the amendments in the Bill of Rights that are violated by the USA Patriot Act, according to the ACLU, 50.
Right, right. And the signing statement, did we see this? I've lost track of the signing statement. The number of signing statements that Bush has signed, which are in contravention of the laws that just got signed by Bush. In other words, this is something that still hasn't really been adequately debated. The point of the signing statements is to say, I don't feel I am obliged to enforce this law.
So he signs the law, then he quietly signs the signing statement.
Right, writes the signing statement. This is the reason I don't believe I have to enforce this law. On the more prosaic money side of the ledger, we have numbers like, this is again during the Bush era, total value of U.S. government contracts in 2000, that were awarded without competitive bidding, $73 billion. Total in 2007, $146 billion. I mean, this is extraordinary. What's what the when you talk about the abuse of power by the Bush administration or by Bush himself, you look at that number and you get a sense of where we are as a country.
How do you do the research for the index? Tell us the history. How did it start 25 years ago?
Well, Lewis Lapham, when he was cooking up this idea for the new format, we still call this the new format of Harper's Magazine 25 years later, because it's 158 years old, and the magazine's 158 years old. And he said so often he read a story in the New York Times or the Washington Post, and there was really just the only interesting thing in the story was one or two numbers. Now, if you could just put those numbers on a page and put them next to another number that amplified the first number, you have an idea of what we were driving at. And what we found out very quickly in the early days of researching the index was that a lot of numbers in the newspaper are false or inaccurate, but they do lead you to other numbers that are accurate. And one of the things we're very proud of is that we fact-check the index very, very thoroughly. So what happens is people see a number or they look for a number, they put it in the computer, and the number frequently sits there for a month or two waiting for a partner. Sometimes a number stands by itself. It's just in and of itself so interesting, it goes right into next year's index. I mean, I just submitted one about tree stealing in upstate New York in the Adirondacks, which I think is emblematic of the going to become a depression. People are stealing lumber out of the Adirondacks because they're desperate for money, and there's going to have to be new enforcement for tree stealing.
Number of incidents of torture on primetime TV networks, TV shows from 2002 to 2007, 897.
But the one that goes with it, it's gone up tremendously, because there was one before, the one above it, if you can find it, is lower. But the point is that torture has become mainstream, it's become a mainstream cultural item in America.
Number in the previous 7 years, 110.
110. So there's been a tremendous, dramatic increase in the number of torture scenarios in mainstream entertainment, because people are getting used to the idea. It's become part of the culture. It's not so shocking to people anymore.
So now you have a book, The Harper's Index Book, Volume 3, edited by Charis Khan and Lewis Lapham, that introduction by George Plimpton.
Right. Well, that's...
That was the beginning.
That was a little bit
ago.
It was a few years ago. But the thing stays current and stays actual and exciting because of the go ahead. Yeah.
Minimum number of pheasant hunts Dick Cheney has gone on since he shot a hunting companion in 2006.
Five.
Days after Hurricane Katrina hit, the Cheney's office ordered an electric company to restore power to two oil pipelines. One. Days after the hurricane that the White House authorized sending federal troops into New Orleans. Four. Portion of the $3.3 billion in federal Hurricane Katrina relief spent by Mississippi that has benefited poor residents, a quarter.
Right. And one thing you'll notice is the difference between the Harper's Index in the 80s and today is that it's much more ambitious. Budget in October 85, we had numbers like budget per episode of Miami Vice, $1,500,000. Under that budget of the Miami Vice Squad in 1984, $1,161,741. One episode of Miami Vice cost more to produce than the entire annual budget of the real Miami Vice Squad. But that reflected a kind of a sillier time, and now it's become more serious in some ways.
Rick MacArthur, I want to thank you for being with us. Congratulations on 25 years of the Harper's Index. That does it for our show. Special happy birthday to Anthony DeMary and to Brenda Murad. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.